Hello, I'm Claire Armitstead. Before you get started with this edition of the Books Podcast, we want to point you in the direction of our sponsor, Squarespace. For everything you need to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian to get 10% off your first purchase. And now, on with the show.
The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Books Podcast. There's no place like home, particularly when the place you come from is filled with secrets and retellings. This week we look at reclaiming histories through the eyes of two young cosmopolitan novelists whose paths have led them to reset the agendas on the countries where they were born.
It's not just you didn't see them, it's also that, you know, Nigerians sometimes, you know, didn't see them. Things like Biafra as well. I was never taught about Biafra in school. And I knew about the Second World War. I grew up in Nigeria, I knew about the Second World War, I knew about the First World War. And I was about 12. And, you know, my mom mentioned in passing there was a Nigerian Civil War. And I was like, what? What do you mean there was a Nigerian Civil War? Why has nobody told me there was a Nigerian Civil War? And, you know, my dad was part of the Nigerian Civil War. And I was like, what? What is all this information? And I think, yeah, fiction is very important in telling just these stories that we've not talked about. And we actually, you think that the knowledge is buried somewhere under, but for some people, for me certainly, the knowledge was not there at all.
We'll look at how family informs us, heart and soul.
For me, this novel was very much about inheritance, not just the kind of physical inheritances that one might have, you know, physical features or objects, but also a kind of emotional inheritance. What is it like to have the same kind of personality as an ancestor when you've never met that ancestor?
And what it's like to be confronting these realities.
I mean, first of all, standing in those dungeons sent me into a rage, you know, to try to, there's no way to rationalize, I guess, how any human could think that this was acceptable. And so that was kind of the beginning of a long journey of rage, I would say.
It was a university research trip that took Yargiassi back to her home country of Ghana in 2009. What she discovered there moved her focus sharply from the simple mother-daughter story she imagined she'd be writing to an epic multi-generational opus covering 300 years and ranging from the late 18th century Gold Coast of West Africa to modern-day America. Homegoing, the title of her debut novel, nods at the old African-American belief that death allowed an enslaved person's spirit to travel back to Africa. Her writing follows that journey, while also powerfully depicting the rich idiosyncratic lives of people living before and during the devastating arrival of the slave traders. Heritage, in Gyasi's writing, means looking past the history books to find one's own truth in order to rewrite that history for the future. Zadie Smith said of it, "It's a novel I wish I could have read when I was a young woman." When Yargiassi joined Richard Lee at The Guardian, she began with a haunting reading.
A soldier came into the dungeon and began to speak. He had to hold his nose to keep from vomiting. The women did not understand him. His voice didn't seem angry, but they had learned to back away at the sight of that uniform, that skin the color of coconut meat. The soldier repeated himself, louder this time, as though volume would coax understanding. Irritated, he ventured further into the room. He stepped in feces and cursed. He plucked the baby from Afia's cradled arms, and Afia began to cry. He slapped her, and she stopped, a learned reflex. Tansi sat next to Essie. The two had made the journey to the castle together. Now that they weren't constantly walking or speaking in hushed tones, Essie had time to get to know her journey friend. Tansi was a hardy and ugly woman, barely turned 16. She was thick, her body built on a solid foundation. Essie hoped and dared not hope that they would be allowed to stay together even longer. "Where are they taking the baby?" Essie asked. Tansi spit onto the clay floor and swirled the spittle with her finger, creating a salve. "They will kill it, I'm sure," she said. The baby was conceived before Fia's marriage ceremony. As punishment, the village chief had sold her to the traders. Afia had told Essie this when she first came into the dungeon, when she was still certain that a mistake had been made, that her parents would return for her. Now, hearing Tensi speak, Afia resumed her crying, but it was as if no one heard. These tears were a matter of routine. They came for all of the women. They dropped until the clay below them turned to mud. At night, Essie dreamed that if they all cried in unison, the mud would turn to river and they could be washed away into the Atlantic. "Tansy, tell me a story, please," Essie begged. But then they were interrupted again. The soldiers came in with the same mushy porridge that had been fed to them in the Fanti village where Essie was held. Essie had learned to swallow it down without gagging. It was the only food they ever received, and their stomachs were empty more days than full. The porridge passed right through her, it seemed. The ground was littered with their waste, the unbearable smell. "Ah, you're too old for stories, my sister," Tansy said once the soldiers left, but Essie knew she would give in soon. Tansy enjoyed the sound of her own voice. She pulled Essie's head into her lap and began playing with her hair, pulling at the strands that had been caked with dust, so brittle that they could be broken. Each one snapped like a twig. "Do you know the story of the Kentikloth?" Tansy asked. Essie had heard it numerous times before, twice from Tansy herself, but she shook her head. Asking if the story had been heard before was a part of the story itself. Tansy began to tell her. Two Ashanti men went out into the forest one day. They were weavers by trade, and they had gone out to hunt for meat. When they got to the forest to collect their traps, they were met by Anansi, the mischievous spider. He was spinning a magnificent web. They watched him, studied him, and soon realized that a spider's web is a unique and beautiful thing, and that a spider's technique is flawless. They went home and decided to weave cloth the way Anansi weaves his web. From there, Kente was born. "You are a fine storyteller," Essie said. Tansy laughed and smoothed the salve she had created onto her knees and elbows to soothe the cracked skin there. The last story she had told Essie was of how she had been captured by the Northerners, plucked from her marriage bed while her husband was off fighting a war. She had been taken with a few other girls, but the rest had not survived.
So how did you get started on a multi-generational story of the transatlantic slave trade?
This novel actually began for me in 2009 when I took a trip to Ghana. I had received a fellowship from Stanford University, where I got my bachelor's degree, to travel to Ghana and conduct research for a novel. And I had a different idea in mind. I wanted to go to the central region where my own mother is from and see if anything struck me. Nothing really was. but a friend came to visit, and really on a whim, we decided to go see the Cape Coast Castle. And it was there that the idea for this novel struck me.
This is the castle that features in the book.
Exactly, the castle that features in the book. It's a slave fort that still stands in Cape Coast, Ghana. And I took the tour with my friend, and the tour guide started to talk to us about how the British soldiers who lived and worked in this castle used to marry the local women, which was something I didn't know. And then from there, he took us down to see the dungeons. And so I kind of knew immediately that I wanted to work on something that would juxtapose those two people, the wife of somebody working in the castle as a trader and a slave kept down below.
Yeah, it's a kind of extraordinary thing to think of this appalling place as a tourist destination.
Yeah, absolutely. It is kind of a strange experience to stand in those dungeons that still smell even after all of these years and try to imagine, I suppose, what these people went through before being sent out through the Middle Passage.
And I guess also a contrast between the kind of perceptions of the people living around this place and the people who then come to it from further away.
Right, exactly. I think a lot of people make a kind of pilgrimage to the Cape Coast Castle. Obama himself was there, I think, a week before I visited. So I think there is this kind of sense of kind of wanting to connect back to that experience.
And equally, I suppose the people living around it, for them, it must be very very difficult place to think about.
Yeah, I don't know how much they do think about it. I've talked to my mother about this because she grew up only 50 miles away but had never really been inside the castle herself. I think there's both this awareness of what the castle stands for and what it means and also this distance from it because it kind of represented something that seemingly belongs to America, you know, and not Ghana itself.
Marcus, who we meet at towards the end of the book, he's doing a PhD about the convict leasing system under which his own grandfather was sent to work in a coal mine. Mm-hmm. He despairs of this research into his PhD, deciding that it was one thing to research something, another thing entirely to have lived it, to have felt it. Mm-hmm. Is that why you wanted to deal with this material through fiction?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I had done a lot of research for this book and read many wonderful books, including The Door of No Return by William St. Clair, a book called The Fanti and the Transatlantic Slave Trade by Rebecca Shumway. And all of these books, you know, I think really struck a chord with me, and yet I felt as though this information kind of deserved to be fictionalized, because fiction, I think, can sometimes allow us to feel something intimately in a way that academic texts and nonfiction can't always do.
As he sits in the library at Stanford, and as you must have done as well, and reads about these historical forces that have shaped his own family, he gets so angry he wants to slam the book down. Yeah. Was it something that sent you into a rage as well?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, first of all, standing in those dungeons sent me into a rage, you know, to try to... There's no way to rationalize, I guess, how any human could think that this was an acceptable place to keep people. And so that was kind of the beginning of a long journey of rage, I would say. The whole entire research process was filled with moments of rage.
Was it difficult in that sense to be coping with the material, to be imagining it?
Yes, absolutely. Difficult to kind of put yourself in the shoes of the characters that you're trying to write about when they are in such devastating and traumatic circumstances.
Mm. The novel is constructed as a series of new starts where you often don't really fill in the gap for the reader. The reader has to jump into a new situation and catch up with what's happening with the next generation of the family. Was this partly as a way of conveying to the reader this experience of being uprooted?
Yes, absolutely. I wanted the novel to feel as though it were structured like a family tree. So you're kind of getting these constant uprootings and shiftings and following these branches down the line and having to try to reconnect where the roots began.
Yeah, but it's a family tree which is torn apart again and again
by
historical forces of which the characters have no control.
Right.
And so this is the idea of jumping in and out of these characters' lives at these various points.
Yes, exactly right.
It's also, I guess, a way of looking at inheritance, of what the characters take down the generations despite these uprootings from one to another.
Yes, for me this novel was very much about inheritance, not just the kind of physical inheritances that one might have, you know, physical features or objects, but also a kind of emotional inheritance. What is it like to have the same kind of personality as an ancestor when you've never met that ancestor? So those were questions that I was thinking about while writing.
You're also happy to follow that into slightly more mystical territory as well.
Sure. I think this novel really compares different ways of thinking in terms of spirituality and religion, and it allows for a kind of mysticism, I think, that sometimes we don't see in the West.
I mean, I was thinking particularly of, I'm not sure if I'm going to pronounce her name, but Akua's versions, her visions of her ancestor, remote ancestor, Mami.
Right. Akua is having these visitations by this figure that she doesn't know, but we are kind of meant to know, is an ancestor who kind of started this entire journey off.
But the novel takes that perfectly seriously, as if this could be something that would happen.
Yes, exactly. I didn't want to kind of privilege one way of believing over another. These things are real to Akua. They're real to her family, and therefore the novel takes them seriously as well.
The Western accounts of the transatlantic slave trade often minimize the culture that was kind of already there, as if it was this great wrong that was done onto this blank slate, this blank canvas.
Right.
Was that, again, one of the things you set out to do with the novel, was to try and give a bit of richness to what was already there?
Yes, I think, you know, having taken that tour in the castle and hearing all of these things that I hadn't really grown up hearing about, not just the British involvement in the slave trade, but particularly the Ghanaian involvement in the slave trade, it just struck me that this was information that you shouldn't have to travel to Ghana and take a tour of a castle in order to get. It's something that we should talk about a little bit more and know about more.
There's Nana Yaa, who compares the Gold Coast to a pot of groundnut soup already full to the brim before the white man came and added fire.
Yes, Right. I think there was already these tensions that existed between the different ethnic groups. The Fanti and the Ashanti were already fighting, and other groups as well. And so I think it was just kind of ripe for exploitation in that way.
It is clearly the external forces came and messed things up. There's certainly a sense of complicity in the novel, but it's far from trying to implicate any kind of blame.
Right. I was careful, I think, to not create a novel where you had villains and heroes. You know, I wanted it to feel nuanced and complicated and to kind of show that at the same time that people were being exploited, they were also doing the exploiting.
It's a very knotty story, isn't it?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
This novel was written under Barack Obama. You say you visited the castle just a week after him or so. It was published in the US with Hillary Clinton 6 points ahead in the poll.
Right.
And now arrives here in the UK at the beginning of a Donald Trump presidency. Yeah. How does that feel?
Oh, how does that feel? It's indescribable that we've kind of taken this long, winding journey to Trump over the 7 years that I've been working on this novel and had this novel come out. On the one hand, it's devastating. And on the other hand, I hope this novel kind of adds to the conversation about ways that we think about our present situation and whether or not we are doing enough to put our present situation in the context of history.
Do you think it changes how the novel feels?
I don't know if it changes how the novel feels. Perhaps it kind of adds a sense of urgency in terms of how a reader might feel reading the novel. Yeah.
Because it seems that back in 2009, in some sense, we all felt on the same page with these issues.
Right. We felt on the same page and perhaps we felt a bit more hopeful than we do now. Perhaps the ending of the novel kind of changes in the light of a Trump presidency. Can we be hopeful or can we not?
Although, I mean, again, looking around the world, back in the US, there's the Black Lives Matter campaigns began in about 2012.
Right.
And if you look further around the world, slavery, it seems, is in human history is more the norm than the exception. And even to this day, you have millions of people working in bondage, in forced labor, in trafficking. So,
These things are very much still present. And, you know, I think this novel shows the cyclical nature of some of these devastating events in history. They don't go away. They kind of bury themselves for a little bit and then they resurface. And it's important to kind of recognize these moments when they crop back up.
And this consensus that we all felt, that we understood, that we were on the same page with these issues is fragile.
Yes, it is fragile. Right, exactly. You might believe one thing and then 4 years later get a different president and have to kind of reassess the way that you believed.
One of your characters, Quay, says you can't stick a knife in a goat and then take it out without any mess. There will always be blood, he says. Mm. Given that the transatlantic slave trade was a great wrong whose effects are still felt to this day on both sides of the ocean, how can we clear up the mess that remains?
I mean, I think it's important first to just recognize that there is a mess that remains. I think a lot of people have a tendency to think of things like slavery as these great wrongs that were committed centuries ago and have no lasting impact. And so step one is to recognize that these things do leave a lasting legacy. And then from there, I don't know, beyond that. Yeah.
I mean, you were talking earlier about how fiction is a way of bringing these issues to life, of living them again in some sense. Can fiction play a part in that?
I think fiction is very good at kind of being able to say these moments won't go unnoticed, right? It's a way of pointing out something that perhaps doesn't get talked about as much as it should and raising awareness in a way that allows a reader to empathize with characters and feel themselves as a part of that, whatever that movement is. Beyond that, I'm not really sure what else fiction can do to kind of correct a wrong, but I think it can point out that a wrong exists.
Was that again, part of the project of the book was to recover these voices.
Yes, absolutely. To kind of lend a voice to groups of people who haven't had an opportunity to speak for themselves and to tell their own stories.
This Guardian podcast is sponsored by Squarespace. To find out more about how to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian.
Another fine young novelist is Chibundu Onuzo. She was born in Nigeria and raised partly there and partly in the UK. Her second book, Welcome to Lagos, is a joyful, irreverent account of Nigeria today. Her Lagos is vibrant, frantic, chaotic, and of the moment. It's a young city as seen by a young writer, though, as she points out, she's older than some people continue to think she is. You first emerged at the age of 21, which I think it irritates you that people still think of you as that very, very young writer, which you were when you published The Spider King's Daughter. You've now, 5 years on, produced your second novel, Welcome to Lagos. Again, it's in Lagos. Tell us a little bit about this particular novel.
Okay, well, I have to say, I first emerged actually at zero, like everybody else, from my mother's womb in Lagos, the city where I was born. And so this novel, Welcome to Lagos, again, is set in Lagos, where I emerged. And it's about 5 or 7, actually, characters. But it starts off with 2 soldiers in the Niger Delta, and they desert the army, and they run away to Lagos because it's a good place to hide. And along the way, they pick up different characters. And when they get to Lagos, they have adventures.
And so in a way, it's a Robin Hood story, one way of looking at it. It's these 5 vagabonds they become, don't they? You've got your 2 soldiers. You've got the wife of a wife-beating husband who's on the run. You've got a young girl who was nearly raped by rebel soldiers down in the Delta States. And then you've got a young boy who was a child rebel, effectively. You're covering an awful lot of the news agenda of Nigeria with these characters.
I suppose so. I mean, I definitely didn't look at it like that. And I must say, these are the 5 characters that survived. So I really wanted to write a novel with a large cast. So I think at a point I had like 20 characters or something. And so they had to be killed, basically. So they were killed off one by one until these 5 remained. And then maybe they are kind of newsy, or maybe that was why I was attracted to these 5. I don't know. But I think they were the strongest. It was a survival of the fittest.
However, although I said that this is a news agenda of Nigeria, what you haven't done is set this up in the north of Nigeria where all the Boko Haram problems are. So you've deliberately, you're looking at the geography of Nigeria for people who are not familiar. This is set down in the south, but starts off in the Delta State where the oil is and then moves up to Lagos. So you've made a deliberate decision not to deal with things like fundamentalism.
Well, I think actually, because I started writing this novel quite a while ago and Boko Haram, if it existed, was definitely not kind of making the headlines that it's making now. And I think actually when I started writing this novel, the Niger Delta was more in the news, actually, especially because there were kidnappings of oil workers and foreign oil workers especially. So actually, the Niger Delta was more in the news, but then I suppose now Boko Haram has taken over the headlines a bit.
So tell us about the story of the novel. Your 5 characters end up on a bus together, driving to Lagos. They get to Lagos, and then suddenly it becomes a sort of caper story.
So they try to find work. I think I just wanted to show them going through the different stages. So first of all, they have to find somewhere to live, and then they have to find jobs, and then they have to find a way to feed themselves. And it is really like the adventures of the 5, you know, moving from stage to stage. And then I introduce a corrupt politician into the mix. And yeah, I think just event after event then keeps happening. And that's kind of how I wrote it as well, because I didn't know how the story was going to end. So there were a lot of and thens that were taking out as well. So they had way more adventures, but then it also had to cohere. And so that was a difficult thing of trying to make them have as many experiences as possible in Lagos, but also trying to make the story coherent so it didn't just become a series of episodes.
Let's just have a reading from the beginning where they are on the bus and they first meet the runaway wife, Omar.
Okay, so this is the first time we hear things from Omar's perspective. Omar climbed down from the bus, a step behind the man from last night. Her husband would be looking for her by now, going through the rooms in their house, opening and shutting drawers, locking and unlocking doors. He would call her brother and her mother, then he would call her friends, that tight circle of wives whose husbands were professionals in Yenagoa. Her husband Ike loved her, in the way you loved expensive shoes, to be polished and glossed, but at the end of the day, to be trodden on. He would never believe she would dare board a bus to Lagos and sit beside a strange man with their legs touching. Yesterday, she had woken up beside her husband, planning to spend her morning in the salon. Ike liked her to look a certain way. Hair curled, eyebrows shaped, and skin the colour of building sand. She served his breakfast of steaming yams, body temperature eggs, and a glass of watermelon juice, blended minutes before Ike sat down. At the door, he had noticed his footprints from last night, dark tracks she had not yet mopped away. "You sit at home and do nothing. At least you can make sure this place doesn't turn into a pigsty." As he walked towards her, she thought, "He'll be late to work, and in the evening, that'll be my fault too." When he was gone, she spat out the blood, a red trickle she rinsed carefully from the basin. Then she arranged her possessions in the bag that now sat on her lap, brushing against the stranger from last night. "Brother Chike, good morning," a young girl said when they disembarked. She was filthy, almost deliberately ungroomed. Ike would have sniggered at her matted hair and clothes smeared with dirt. There were two other men with this Chike. "Good morning, I hope you slept well. I didn't introduce myself yesterday. I'm Chike. Ifoma, but everyone calls me Oma. What are you doing now?" "Taking my friend Isoke home." You know what? My cousin may not be awake yet. Maybe. I was thinking that. I said that I would help you find somewhere to stay. How about I follow you to drop Isoke, if the place is not too far? Then I'll show you a good area." "I don't want to disturb your plans." "No, not at all. I need to be doing something while I'm waiting for my cousin." On the strength of a midnight conversation, Oma trusted this man who did not know enough of Lagos to threaten her. Better to walk with Chike than remain in the bus park until touts began to circle her. They boarded a bus, a metal carcass on wheels with a floor like a grater, coin-sized holes through which you could see the road streaking by. She would find a space for herself in this city, even if her cousin should turn her away. Lagos was big enough. "Owa," the girl said. The bus slowed for them to disembark.
So what you've got there is you've got a snapshot of the class differences. They're very different. But Omar is middle class and the others are not. Well, certainly Azoke is not.
Mm.
Tell us a little bit about this particular aspect of the setup.
Mm. I would say actually Omar is definitely upper middle class, if not elite. I think in other countries she might be middle class. But the thing is the contrast between someone who has at a time been rich enough to even travel out of the country means that in comparison to the vast number of Nigerians, she's actually quite kind of high up in the pecking order. And so I wanted that kind of tension to arise between she's desperate enough to leave her husband, but I think she would rather she had turned up with a more polished band or gang. But then she needs, I think that's in the early parts of the book, the group survives because they need to stay together, not necessarily because they like each other or they think, you know, very highly of each other. Because I think Oma is definitely, she's definitely a snob. And I wanted her to hold on to her snobbery because, you know, people don't just change because, like, people, someone can be a victim as well as an oppressor at the same time.
And both Izokan and Oma, as women, are also victims, aren't they? They're also very vulnerable. So we see Izokan, who is delivered to an uncle's house, but the uncle, is it a real uncle? And what are his intentions towards her? Oma, we've already heard, is beaten up by her husband.
Mm.
So there's all this, it's a sort of cross-hatching going on that maybe seems sort of strange to us reading it in England, the particular vulnerability of women in this society.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose domestic violence does happen everywhere, but I think it's quite widespread in Nigeria and it goes across, again, all classes. I mean, that also happens here, but I think it's something that shocked me when I grew older. And then I realised that we knew people who had been in such situations. I mean, when you're a child, you don't quite understand. But, you know, there were people who had been abused by their husbands.
So what happens? I think I can probably give away the beginning of the plot.
Okay.
At least as they end up in an empty house. And then in Bumble's Chief Sandayo.
Yes.
With 10 million naira.
Dollars.
Dollars. $10 million. He doesn't even have it in Nigerian money.
Yes. So first of all, so I have this character, Chief Sandayo, and he's a politician and he is, on the surface anyway, like a type. that you recognize the corrupt African politician. But I was also interested in idealism and politics in Nigeria and how idealism is not enough. So the first time you meet Chief Sandayo, he's a very frustrated minister of education. And I think I got this from reading kind of accounts of people who had been politicians, and they were talking about the bureaucracy. And so even if you are well-meaning and you are not corrupt, the layers and layers of inefficiency mean that you probably be also very ineffectual. So you don't actually have to steal money for things not to work. You just have to sit there and not know how to cut through all that bureaucracy. And you'll be as frustrated as, or you'll be as ineffective as somebody who is actively just out to be corrupt. So that's the first time you meet Chief Sandayo.
And he has a backstory, which is that he was an idealist.
Yes, exactly.
And he'd actually really done a lot for Yoruba education.
Yes, exactly. And I think there are individuals, you know, we can think of, you know, who were idealists outside politics. Then they went in and then they didn't do much. And it wasn't necessarily because they were corrupt. It's just, I think for some people, they just met a system that they just did not know how to handle or change. So that's where Chief Sandayo starts off. But then halfway through the novel, he appears and, you know, if you can't beat them, join them kind of thing. And so he appears with this money and it's kind of like a shock to the group system.
It's a shock and also a pleasurable experience in a way, in that it gives them power, because money is what gives you power in a big city like Lagos.
Definitely. And then they have to decide, you know, what to do with this money. They have to decide what choices to make with this money.
And the other dimension of it, which we haven't mentioned, which is the seventh character, you mentioned there are seven characters, is the newspaper man.
Yes.
Of course, because part of the whole story is who is prepared to tell the truth.
Mm.
And so you have Ahmed, who's running a paper which is failing, as lots of papers do. He doesn't know quite how brave he's prepared to be. And he runs into this story.
So with Ahmed, again with him, I wanted to... So his parents are part of the elite. They are. He suspects them of being corrupt. And he has lived a life that has benefited from all this corruption. And so as an adult, he kind of rejects that. And then becomes a sort of social commentator, crusader, all of this. But then I think you can never escape. He's as much complicit as Chief Sandayo. And I think that's something that this character is trying to deal with throughout the novel.
So he's always trying to get the courage, isn't he? I mean, it's partly about how can you be brave? How can you live a good life in a society where everything is for sale, basically? Each of the chapters, a lot of the chapters, open with a bit of editorial from the paper. And in one case, there's a joke. What do you call an honest Lagosian dead? I imagine that didn't go down too well with your family.
No, it didn't. My aunt was not amused at all. She was like, why are you saying that about Lagos and Nigerians? It's a joke.
But they still live, your family still live in Lagos.
Yes, my parents live in Lagos. And I go back pretty often, actually, at least once a year, sometimes more. I think what's interesting is that when you come from here, and this is another thing I try to show in the novel, I try to show people arriving from different places. So you have people like Chike. So that's the how people who aren't very wealthy arrive in Lagos. You come by public transport, you come by bus. And when you're moving from a very rural part of Nigeria and you move to Lagos, it is dazzling. I think the first time it actually struck me was when I went to my village 2-3 years ago, and I was there for a week, and there was very little internet, very little phone connectivity, very little electricity. And then I came back to Lagos and we drove into Lagos. And it was just like, wow, there's so much stuff. There's so much infrastructure. There are billboards. There's so much. It's actually quite a shock on the senses. And that's how Chike and the Merry Band, that's how they experience it the first time they come into Lagos. But then I also wanted to show when people from England come into Lagos. And then they're just like, nothing works. This place is just run down. All the infrastructure is horrible. And I wanted to show these different kind of arrivals and exitings and just the different lenses which you can view a city.
And there is a tradition of Lagos novels now. I mean, it's a very lively and growing tradition to which this novel contributes, and to which your last novel, Spider King's Daughter, contributed also, which was a sort of Romeo and Juliet story of a rich girl and a poor boy getting together. Do you relate consciously to this tradition?
I mean, I don't know how, obviously, I'm not Adam. I'm not the first man to write it, or first person to write a Lagos novel. But at the same time, I just don't feel that there are that many. I think increasingly now, this is like, what does it say, the zeitgeist. So like a lot of people are writing Lagos novels. But I think 5 years ago, 7 years ago, so Chimamanda, for example, which is like one of our recent like greatest literary exports. So a lot of her novels are set in Eastern Nigeria. So Purple Hibiscus, Half of a Yellow Sun.
That's Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie.
Yes, Adichie. Yes. And I was reading a book by Kay Whiteman, which is a nonfiction book about Lagos. And he was saying that actually a lot of Nigeria's kind of more famous writers, they didn't really engage with Lagos. So Chinua Achebe as well, actually, didn't really engage very much with the city. He did, but not in a very flattering way. Most of his most famous works are set again in Eastern Nigeria, in the more rural settings. Wole Soyinka as well, his plays, a lot of them are set in Abeokuta. So yes, I think the Lagos novel is actually
quite recent.
Fairly recent. So like there have been, but I think our most famous Nigerian books are not Lagos novels.
There's one scene that I was very interested in because I actually grew up in Nigeria.
Oh,
and
okay.
I went to Badagry at one point, at the island of Badagry, which is off Lagos.
Mm.
And I was just aware of it as a sort of a desert island in which the company my father worked for had a negotiation with the local chief, which they had to renew. They had a lease and they had to renew it with a bottle of gin and £26 or something like that. But you have a much darker history invested in this island, which is the manacles that were put on slaves.
Mm.
So there's a very deep history underneath this novel, about a very modern city.
Mm. I think, yeah. So like the history of Lagos is, by Lagosians as well, by people living in Lagos, is not, preservation is not really on the top of the list. What Lagos is trying to do now is become a 21st century glass and steel, all of that. And there have been a lot of controversies. So like there's a famous building built by Brazilian ex-slaves who returned to Lagos that was pulled down to make way for some development. And there's this kind of clash between all those historical things that actually happened in the city or around the city. So with Badagry, where you reference, you know, it's a slave fort. And then those are where the slaves, that was the last place they went to before they were taken from Nigeria. It wasn't Nigeria at the time, but before they were taken away from the continent. And for now, all those buildings and some of the chains that were used and that type of stuff is still being preserved. But, you know, if tomorrow some developer has an idea of saying, oh, why don't we build some, like, you know, $20 million shopping mall in Badagry? It's possible that, you know, those will just be erased. Because.
But what is so fascinating is, to me, mm-hmm. is that I went there and I was totally unaware of this.
Ah.
And this seems to me partly what fiction is doing for Africa and for Nigeria, mm. because I have a particular interest in Nigeria, is it's suddenly you realise it's there. It was there all along. These mm. stories were there all along, but we didn't see them.
Mm.
And you're part of that. Your writing is part of that.
I hope so. I mean, but it's not just you didn't see them. It's also that, you know, Nigerians sometimes, you know, didn't see them. And it's not just with Badagry, it's with things like Biafra as well. I was never taught about Biafra in school. And I think, and I knew about the Second World War. I grew up in Nigeria. I knew about the Second World War. I knew about the First World War. And I was about 12. And, you know, my mom mentioned in passing there was a Nigerian Civil War. And I was like, what? What do you mean there was a Nigerian Civil War? Why has nobody told me there was a Nigerian Civil War? And, you know, my dad was part of the Nigerian Civil War. And I was like, what? What is all this information? And I think, yeah, fiction is very important. So, of course, Half of a Yellow Sun as well, in telling just these stories that we've not talked about. And we actually, you think that the knowledge is buried somewhere under, but for some people, for me certainly, the knowledge was not there at all.
At your book launch, you sang a rather wonderful Nigerian folk song. What is the relationship between your music and your writing?
So I think it helps in some way with the rhythm of the sentences. So like I read everything I write aloud. So I've definitely read this novel aloud like 50,000 times. And I think just the cadences, I think music definitely helps with that.
And there is also a musical strand in the novel.
Yes, so I have like a singer and I also have some Igbo music as well in the novel. So, I mean, again, if you don't know the song, it doesn't matter. But I think for Nigerians who grew up in the Biafran War. So there's a particular song that was sung often in the war by the Igbo side. And so, yes, I have that song in the novel.
Do you think this novel would mean something different to people who understood the difference between Igbo and Yoruba? You're both, you're Igbo and Yoruba. Are there things that we're missing? You've got quite a lot of dialect in it, for example, or pidgin, rather.
Well, I don't know that you're missing. Well, it's just like, it's another layer. And I think, so for example, I have the BBC journalist, and I think if you live here and watch the BBC, then there are some strands and in-jokes that only people who live here and watch the BBC will get. And then it's the same thing for the Nigerian section. So everybody gets something.
You have another life. You're a very successful newspaper columnist, including for The Guardian. You're very opinionated and mouthy, and you're not frightened. How do you put these two sides of you together? And you're very keen on education. That's one of your themes, isn't it? There is education running as a stream through this, the importance of giving opportunity to poor children. How do you marry those two sides of you so that your fiction doesn't become too didactic and your columns don't become too fanciful?
That's a very good way of putting it. I guess with The Guardian, I try to only write about things I'm interested in. Because sometimes, you know, my editor will call me and say, you know, do you have anything to say on this issue? And I try not to manufacture opinions and say no. So I only say stuff that I feel strongly about. And I feel I have something coherent to say. How does this affect my fiction? I don't know. I mean, I hope the fiction is not didactic. And maybe it's just natural that I am drawn to news topics. And I think it's something that has come up. And in a lot of interviews, I've not done that many, but in the few I've done for this book, there's the theme of corruption that keeps being brought up. But then I don't think it's just a novel about corruption. And I think sometimes, and also with African writers, when you do focus on one of the newsy themes, or when you draw out a newsy theme and put it in your novel, then that becomes the only thing this novel is about. But then it's also about other things like family and just Lagos life and hustling and, you know, walking on the streets of Lagos that have not much to do with corruption. So, like, corruption is a theme, but there are other themes. Yeah, I'm not just interested in the more didactic things. So I hope my observations about life and the smaller things, in quotes, balance the more political stuff.
It's interesting that people have picked up that, because I would say this is a book about family and how in a new urban environment you make a family. And these are all people who've escaped from traditional ideas of family because they haven't worked for them in the new environment. They might have worked 50 years ago, but they're not appropriate. So they are the family because they live together in the same place.
Yeah. So yeah, exactly. That's one theme that I really wanted to like explore, in the sense that you can choose your family. You can choose the people, you know, who you choose to make your family.
You're 26.
Yes, I am 26.
You're incredibly young to have two novels and a journalistic career under your belt. Where are you going next? Will you stay in England? Will you go back to Nigeria? Will it be fiction? Will it be columns?
So at the moment, I'm doing a PhD, just finishing. So I'm in my final year.
What's your PhD?
So it's on the West African Students Union, and I'm doing it at King's College, so it's history. Yeah, I think the PhD will influence my writing, because what I'm looking at in particular is the students who were here in the 1920s, 30s, 40s. They were part of this union, and they went back home and they became political leaders. So you had people like Kwame Nkrumah, Jomo Kenyatta, just almost any African leader you can think of. They were students here at a point and they went back. And I'm looking at how their time they spent here kind of influenced what they then went on to do when they got back home. So I hope to use this PhD in some way.
Maybe you'll be turning to historical fiction next, set in England in the 1920s.
Well, yes, there we go. Wolf Hall.
That was the remarkable voice of Chibundu herself singing her version of a traditional Nigerian song. Welcome to Lagos is published by Faber and Faber, and Homegoing by Yar Gyasi is published by Viking in the UK and Knopf in the US. They're both out in paperback now. Next week, we're looking at the fact and fiction of autobiographical novels with the enfant terrible of French fiction, Édouard Louis. And if you're interested in cities and their structures, why don't you take a listen to our fellow Guardian technology podcast, Chips with Everything.
Imagine if the cities of the future could someday repair themselves. What if they could even detect things like potholes and sinkholes before they even happen? We'll be taking a look at the concept of self-healing cities and how far off or how near they might really be.
For more literary interviews, discussions and live events, search for Guardian Books Podcast. You can find us at theguardian.com, on iTunes, on SoundCloud, or by swiping and tapping on your smartphone. Just open up your favourite podcast app. And you can join the conversation too in person, either by commenting on the Guardian website or at Guardian Books on Twitter. But from me, Claire Armitstead, and my producer, Susanna Trezillian, thanks for listening and goodbye.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.